This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rock Cash, your host this week on the People Speak Radio. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can call in 760-569-7676, then entering access code 192919, pound when prompted. If you have a computer or a smartphone, you can dial into bbsradio.com, navigate to station 2, click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with a call-in question for our guests this evening. The toll-free number in the United States and Canada is 1-888-429-5471. Our guest tonight, Arnie Gunderson. Arnie is a nuclear engineer and a whistleblower. In 1990, Arnie discovered radioactive material in an accounting safe at the Nuclear Energy Services in Danbury, Connecticut. The consulting firm where he was employed 3 weeks after notifying the president of the company what he believed to be radiation safety violations, he was fired in 1990. Arnie, welcome to the People Speak Radio. Can you please fill us in on the entire situation, why you were fired, and what the severity of it pertains to be?
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to talking today. When I was in my early 40s, I was a senior vice president of a firm, and we had a nuclear license to handle radioactive material. I found a whole bunch of violations at the company I was working for, and I told the president of the company. And like you said, he fired me 3 weeks later. So I went to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and you know, I really believed that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would come to my assistance, and they deliberately and knowingly botched the inspection, and then they were also taking bribes from my employer. So at that point, I got Senator John Glenn involved, and Senator John Glenn ran the Senate Government Oversight Committee. And he had responsibility for the inspectors general. And he got the inspectors general to investigate the NRC. And they determined that the inspection had been deliberately botched and that the NRC inspectors were taking bribes as well. So the long and the short of it is that on the federal level is that I was technically exonerated. But then it got worse. I was sued for $1.5 million because I wrote to Congress. Well, of course, the reason I wrote to Congress is because the NRC didn't do anything. And the NRC refused to step in and say that this lawsuit was a slap suit, strategic litigation against public participation. So they basically let us twist in the wind. And Maggie and I and the family went bankrupt. We lost the house. We lost our pensions and everything. Finally, 6 years later, we reached an out-of-court settlement with the with my previous employer, and life goes on. You know, I became a consultant, and at the same time, I was also teaching math at the local college and a local school. And gradually, since then, I've been doing more and more consulting, and now, of course, it's a full-time job. So one moves on from the downturns in your life.
Good. I've been reading up a little bit about you, and you're also showing concerns about a lot of our nuclear plants here in the United States as being faulty and possibly very dangerous to the American public.
You know, I wrote frequently about a plant down in Florida, Crystal River, and I said that the plant could never come back online. And the nuclear industry wound up 4 years later agreeing with me and saying, "Oh my God, this plant can never come back online." I was testifying out in California about two plants, the San Onofre plants. And I said, you can fix these plants, but you can't just plug them and start back up. And after 18 months of dragging their feet, they threw in the towel and they said, plugging them is not going to work and we've wasted too much time. So we've lost the opportunity. That here in Vermont, on Vermont Yankee, I discovered that the executives had not told the truth to the Public Service Commission and they were removed from their job. So, you know, I've been portrayed as being against nuclear when in fact, the things I've discovered, the nuclear industry has agreed with me with. Now I guess I'm going into it with my eyes wide open, and you know, I see them as I call them as I see them, and there's a lot of plants out there that are underfunded and dangerous, and those are the ones that I like to talk about and try to get some public response on.
Well, with the effects of the Three Mile Island meltdown, I'm sure that they, you know, would have placed more regulations on the regulatory system of the nuclear plants. But it seems that they're not really concerned with the public welfare. They're more concerned with the corporate finances.
You know, it starts at the top, and there's five nuclear regulatory commissioners. It's a nuclear regulatory commission. And those five guys are appointed by Congress, and five people, two are women, three are men. Four of the five are pro-nuclear, and the other one's neutral at best. And you got to remember, they're congressional appointees. All of them have been vetted by the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is the nuclear industry spokesperson. So you don't get a job as a commissioner at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission unless the industry says you're a good guy. Well, that's a little bit backward in my opinion, but it's driven from the top. If you've got the five guys running the place pro-nuclear, you're going to wind up with the 4,000 people on the staff giving opinions that they want to hear.
Oof. That's a tough call. I mean, they are placing in the hands of these five people the lives of the American public, and it seems like these five people really don't care about what goes on or what happens to the public, including the rapid rate of cancer that we have going on in this country. And now we're also learning that Fukushima, they're planning on releasing the waste into the waters. What are the consequences of all this?
Yeah, the Fukushima isn't planning to do it. It's kind of running out the side of the plant without planning, and that's even worse. You know, at Fukushima, what happened was that these are old designs. I actually said it repeatedly years before the accident that if there was going to be an accident, it was going to be in this type of plant. 3 weeks before the accident, Maggie and I were walking around the street that one night getting our evening constitutional. And she said, you know, we do a lot of expert reports. Where's the next accident going to occur? And I told her, I don't know where, but I do know it's going to be in a General Electric Mark I reactor. And son of a gun, 3 weeks later, there's Fukushima. So that it happened shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. As a matter of fact, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was on a conference call 4 days after the accident. This is a Monday or Tuesday after the accident. And one of their head guys, a guy named Chuck Casto, was recorded as saying, "This is the worst containment in the world." Well, we've got 23 of them in the United States that are still operating, and about 18 of them are in Chuck Casto's backyard. He runs Region 3, which is out of Chicago. And if he thinks that this is the worst containment in the world, why the heck do we still have 23 of them running? Now, to get to your question about the leaks, though, the plant had a huge earthquake, and it's the that coast of Japan dropped 3 feet. So you know, it's literally 3 feet lower than it was when before the earthquake. And the building's foundations cracked. And then on top of that, these nuclear containments got incredibly hot, and they pumped salt water in to cool it. Well, what that does is all of the rubber fittings that hold all the wires that go through the containment all rotted out and broke. So essentially, whatever radiation is inside the containment isn't being contained anymore. It's leaking out through all these holes where the penetrations were. So it's in the groundwater. And TEPCO can't control taking it out of the groundwater. So what they're doing is they're collecting it in tanks, and they about 400 tons a day is leaking into the basement of the plant. Like your house and the sump pump isn't working. So 400 tons are leaking into the basement of the plant, and they're building a tank every 2 days, three tanks a week to collect all of this radioactive water. The problem is they're slapping these things together really quickly and poorly, and now they're starting to leak. So the basements are already leaking, and the tank farm is leaking as well. What really frightens me is that all of these pipes are connected by plastic pipe, just like you have on your swimming pool. And the problem is that if there's another earthquake, those plastic pipes are going to snap, and all that radiation that's in now 800 tanks is going to break and run right down the hill and directly into the ocean. So the ocean's getting a double whammy. They're getting it from the foundations that are leaking, and they're getting it from leaks in the tank farm. It's the biggest release to the ocean of any nuclear reactor accident in history.
So you're saying that all this radiation is in PVC pipes?
Yes, that's right. You know, when the plant was built, it was in steel pipe, but of course, after the accident, they've been slapping stuff together as quick as they possibly can. And, you know, the pipes are leaking. And, yeah, we're using PVC pipes. And, of course, then we had the rats that were eating the wires and shutting the cooling systems down and things like that. So you've got a rat-infested site that's being held together with PVC pipes.
Oh, man. Oh, my goodness. What is the thickness of that PVC pipe? I mean, you know, the ones we use in building and things of that nature are very, very thin. Are they using a very thick one? And what can radiation possibly do to it?
Well, the pipe in your house is that white pipe, and that's called SCED 40, Schedule 40. The pipe they use industrially and like in industrial swimming pools is a gray pipe, and that's called Schedule 80. It's a little thicker. And these pipes are Schedule 80. They're the gray pipe. But, you know, it's not about the radiation attacking the plastic. It's that when the ground moves in the event of an earthquake or just general ground movement, plastic is not flexible. Plastic snaps. And the pipe that the tank that leaked about 3 weeks ago leaked where the plastic pipe was screwed into the side of the steel tank. And, of course, you know, in the event of an earthquake, all that plastic is up for grabs.
And what is the circumstances of the devastation capability of it being released into the water and the what marine life and everything around there? Would that actually contaminate the entire ocean around the world, or would it be diluted? What are the consequences of it?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question right now. TEPCO isn't telling, Tokyo Electric, TEPCO, is not telling us what's in those tanks. It's likely that there's some very nasty isotopes like strontium-90 and cesium-137 in those tanks, as well as another isotope called tritium. Strontium-90 is a bone seeker that causes leukemia. Cesium is a muscle seeker that causes tumors, and there's an enormous inventory sitting on that hill. If they break, they will clearly overwhelm the little dike that's out in front of the plant and enter the Pacific. Now, the one good thing is that the Pacific is a big place, So it will get diluted as it moves across the ocean. But right now we've got a plume, a wedge of cesium moving across the ocean now, and it's about a year from hitting the Pacific West Coast of the U.S. And the ocean has had cesium-137 in it since nuclear bomb testing back in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. But the concentration on the other side of this wedge is 10 times higher than what's in the ocean now from bomb testing. So we're seeing an appreciable increase in cesium right now, even though the tank farm is still intact. It wouldn't surprise me that it would be 10 times higher if the tank farm were to break. One of the problems, and hopefully your listeners will view this as an ask, you got to ask your representatives to measure these fish. We are not adequately measuring the fish in the Pacific. And if we are, I don't know about it, and I'm really up on these issues. So if the government is measuring the fish, I don't want to hear, well, it's below regulatory limits. I want to know what the numbers are. And then I can make a choice whether it's just below the regulatory limit or it's inconsequential. But I need to be an informed consumer. And I think that it's critical that we all know, one, the government is testing, and two, what the numbers are. So we're in the dark on that right now. And without that information, it's really difficult. If I were on the Pacific West Coast, I tell you, I'd be knocking on my congressman's door saying, I want the FDA to test the fish, and I want the FDA to tell me what the numbers are.
You're listening to The People Speak live on the BBS Radio Network with our guest, Arnie Gunderson. Arnie, let's talk about a person that I believe you know. His name is Lake Barrett, and I believe he is advising, or the U.S. is advising them to actually dump the rest of the radioactive material into the ocean.
Yeah, I knew Lake Barrett back in the 1970s. He and I served on a couple national committees when I was an engineer and he was with the NRC. The NRC brought him in to Three Mile Island almost immediately after the accident. And it was his lowball estimates that the NRC still has on their website. You know, if you go up on the NRC website, they'll say nobody died after Three Mile Island, and the releases were 10 million curies. Well, that's all from Lake Barrett. But when you actually look at the analysis that Lake Barrett did, it was on the back of an envelope, and it was wrong. So here's the guy who minimized Three Mile Island when he was a young man, and now, when he's an old man, what happens? He's doing exactly the same thing at Fukushima. He's saying that, it doesn't matter. We can pump these tanks into the ocean and not to worry. Now, there's a thing called the London Dumping Convention. It's been shortened to the London Convention, but the official name is the London Dumping Convention. And it happened in 1972. And it was really one of the big successes of Greenpeace. Nations were taking nuclear waste into drums, putting it out on ships and dumping it in the ocean. And Greenpeace especially and other organizations got the London Dumping Convention to stop the dumping of radioactive waste into the ocean. So if Tokyo Electric took this stuff and put it in drums and put it on a boat and shipped it out in the ocean and dumped it, that would be illegal. But if you pump it offshore from your own tanks, that's not covered by the London Dumping Convention. So, you know, the Tokyo Electric is exploiting the law by essentially pumping this stuff into the ocean, when in fact what they're doing was essentially illegal 40 years ago.
Now, is this same process going on here in the United States at the San Onofre plant, at Three Mile Island, at any of the other plants here in the United States?
Boy, that's a really good question. You know, like I said before, the Pacific is a really big place. And here we have an accident on the Pacific Ocean, and, you know, we've contaminated the largest body of water on the planet. If this accident had occurred on the Missouri River or the Mississippi River or on the Great Lakes, we would have wiped out the water supply to 40 million people. And yet policymakers are not considering that what's already happened at Fukushima Daiichi could happen other places in the United States. Now, nuclear plants in the States, when they're operating normally, release small amounts of radiation, but nowhere near as the amount that Fukushima Daiichi is releasing. But I think the lesson here is that what makes us so special? Why do we think that it can't happen in the United States? If it were Vermont Yankee, it would contaminate the entire Connecticut River and all of Long Island Sound, you know, the lifeblood of New York City. So the contamination of sources of water from a major nuclear accident is something that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission refuses to admit can happen, even though it's happening right now in Japan.
Oof. Well, Arnie, we have a couple of questions. I'm going to take some questions from the listeners. I have Ken from Washington, and he's asking, what is your take on the depleted uranium in Iraq and other places?
Yeah, my specialty is nuclear power. But let me talk a little bit about the depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is almost pure uranium-238. In nature, uranium is 99% 238 and about 0.7% 235. And we enrich it. We pull out the little bit of 235, and what's left is essentially pure uranium-238. And it's what they call pyrophoric, which means it burns in air with a fire that water can't put out. So if you get depleted uranium burning, and you were to throw water on it, it actually makes the fire worse because the water sucks up the hot water is H2O. So the oxygen from water gets sucked out of the water into the uranium, and it liberates hydrogen, which blows up. So it's an ideal weapon because it's pyrophoric. If you shoot it at the enemy's tank, the friction of the shell as it goes through the metal causes the shell to burn, and it's a fire that cannot be put out. The problem is that it atomizes the uranium into small particles, literally atomic-sized particles. And our GIs and the enemy that got hit by the shell and the people in Fallujah and all that stuff are being exposed to DU as a gas from the from the explosions of the cells. DU is depleted uranium, and it's entered their lungs, and now we're picking it up in their urine, and there's high cases of birth defects and things like that. So DU as a weapon if you were a military guy, it's probably the ideal weapon. You don't need an explosive to cause the explosion. Just the heat of friction will get it to burn. But from a humanitarian standpoint, it's awful. And the reason is that it doesn't kill you immediately. It kills you 20 years later from a cancer that it induced. And that's really not what the Geneva Convention is all about.
Wow. This is really mind-blowing. I have a question from Brian in Rancho Cucamonga, California, and he wants to know if a nuclear plant can be built to be absolutely safe, as some people assure us.
You know, I've said that nuclear can be cheap and nuclear can be safe, but it can't be both. Maybe it can be safer, but it can't be built inexpensively. A good friend of mine is a former nuclear regulatory commissioner. His name is Peter Bradford, and when we keep looking at these new nukes as some kind of a panacea, the problem is nobody's looking at the cost. And Bradford's comment was, trying to solve global warming by building nuclear power plants is like trying to solve global hunger by serving caviar. It doesn't make economic sense. So, you know, the nuclear industry always touts some new thing, a thorium reactor or a small modular reactor or a really big reactor, when the current generation has proven to be uneconomical. And we constantly buy the argument that there's a, that just around the corner, 20 more years, we'll have a better reactor. It reminds me of Little Orphan Annie. You remember the song, you know, the sun will come out tomorrow, and tomorrow's always a day away. I actually call this the Little Orphan Annie syndrome. You know, we're always looking toward tomorrow, but it's always a day away.
Okay, we've got a live call from Mike in California. Mike in California, welcome. Can you fill us in on what your question is, please?
Yes, Arnie, you know, I need to know a little bit more about this Lake Barrett, the U.S. advisor to Japan. Is there any oversight on this? I mean, how did he end up becoming the advisor, and do you think the Japanese will take his advice seriously, and why would they?
Boy, that's a great question. They hired him, Tokyo Electric hired him as their advisor. They also hired another American, a former NRC commissioner, a guy named Dale Klein. He was a chairman of the NRC. And if you want to look up Dale Klein, the Houston Chronicle, I think it was, ran a great story about Dale Klein, and it was called Will Shill for Nukes. And what they discovered is that NEI, the Nuclear Energy Institute, was writing editorials, which Dale Klein was then signing and representing as his own before he became the chairman of the NRC. So here's a guy who's supposed to be impartial is actually taking NEI material, you know, by the organization that's responsible for promoting nuclear power, and publishing it in publications as if it were his own. That's the problem. What we're getting at Fukushima Daiichi now is the nuclear industry is circling the wagons and trying to protect Tokyo Electric and trying to protect nuclear power too. I think that that Dale Klein is on the payroll and that Lake Barrett is on the payroll is an indication that the industry is trying to tell people, you know, don't worry, be happy. It's under control. I'm talking to medical doctors and scientists in Japan who are telling me they're under enormous pressure not to tell the truth. You know, they've got data and they can't get it published. And doctors who can't talk to their patients about a radiation-induced illness. So there's enormous top-down pressure from the Japanese government to downplay the significance of this. The Prime Minister of Japan, a guy named Abe, A-B-E, was just over in Turkey trying to sell nuclear power plants. And one of the things he said is, I've got to get them working in my country so I can go over to Turkey and sell them to them. So the commercial pressures on the Japanese legislature, the Diet, have always been great. Tokyo Electric has had a stranglehold on the Diet for 20 years. And even after the accident, they're still not appreciating the damage they're doing to the public. One of the things I recommended, and it actually was in a letter to Ban Ki-moon today, who Ban Ki-moon is the head of the UN, was that one, Tokyo Electric be eliminated. They shouldn't be running the cleanup at Fukushima Daiichi. It should be an international firm with public oversight. But the other piece of it is that the Japanese government has never told the people of Japan that this is a $500 billion cleanup. And I think that the Japanese government owes it to their people to admit the magnitude of the problem. And if people understood the magnitude of the problem, maybe they'd say, geez, I don't think we want to start our other nuclear plants back up. It's too much of a risk. What's happening in Japan now is they're kind of drizzling out, $10 billion every 3 months. Oh, it's another $10 billion. It's another $10 billion. But nobody's looking at the elephant in the room. Nobody's looking at the fact that the overall cleanup Fukushima Prefecture, which is like a state the size of Connecticut, plus cleaning up the nuclear site, is going to be a half a trillion U.S. dollars. That's a big nut for any country to chew on. And the Japanese people just don't appreciate what they're up against.
Arnie, that was my next question. If the solution is some kind of international intervention, is there anything being done on that, or would you like to head something like that, addressing that at the United Nations?
I would love to do something to get the international cooperation, which is why I wrote to Ban Ki-moon with 17 other scientists today. But the real issue is there has to be one international scientist who don't have an agenda have to get involved. You know, Maggie and I get calls all the time from American companies that are being excluded from working in Japan. 2+ years ago, I started talking about a zeolite trench. Zeolite is a radioactive material that you put in the ground to keep the radiation from moving out of it. There's a company in the United States that's done that up at West Valley in New York State, and the Japanese won't let them do it at Fukushima. There's another company that cleans that can clean the soil and remove about 80% of the radiation in it. And they've been excluded from working in Japan. So there's an enormous number of international companies that would love to help the Japanese and have been excluded. But if it's just a matter of letting one company replace another without public oversight, it frightens me that we'll go right down the same road again.
With that being said, we need to take a break, guys. Mike, if you want to stay on the line and ask more questions, please do so. We need to take a break and listen from our sponsors here on the People Speak Radio on the BBS Network. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit UNICEFUSA.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
Welcome back to the People Speak Radio on the BBS Radio Network. My guest, Arnie Gunderson, whistleblower on the nuclear systems that have been faulty. Arnie, welcome back. We have a question for you from one of our listeners. This one wants to know if Benjamin Netanyahu was accurate when he showed us the Wile E. Coyote Acme bomb drawing at the UN setting. The actual timetable of stage one, stage two, and stage three refinement of uranium. And this is a question is brought to you by Dan from England.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't know what Netanyahu was talking about. You're going to either have to give me some more, or I'm going to have to punt on this question.
Well, there was a bomb drawn on a piece of paper that Netanyahu actually brought up. But if you're not familiar with it, let's move on to the next question. Dave in Canada, are you aware of any evidence that Israel and the United States created Stuxnet virus affected the Siemens controllers at the Fukushima?
You know, I was asked something similar on a show about 4 or 5 months ago, and the Stuxnet virus actually happened. It was likely used against the uranium enrichment facilities, but what happened in Fukushima is actually worse. I can't blame the CIA or the Israeli equivalent of the CIA for the Daiichi accident. I have to blame mankind. I have to blame the American engineers that built the plant and the Japanese engineers who signed off on it. You know, Fukushima Daiichi was built by General Electric, and they were in California, and it was built by Ibasco, Electric Bond and Stock Company. It was an engineering firm in Manhattan. And I was at both of their offices when I was an engineer. And they made decisions about the height of the tsunami wall. And they said that the worst tsunami that could ever hit Daiichi was going to be 4 meters or about 12 feet. And that was ultimately raised to 5 meters or about 15 feet. And they also then cut the bank down. The bank at Fukushima Daiichi was 100 feet high. And they cut it down to about 25 feet high so they could get the nuclear plant close to the water. So back up the hillside near Fukushima Daiichi is an ancient marker. It's 700 years old. And it was a warning from the great-great-great-great-great-great grandparents of the people who built this plant. And it said, don't build below this line. You know, respect the ocean. But in our hubris, in mankind's hubris, we thought we could beat Mother Nature. And Mother Nature won. You know, the tsunami that hit Fukushima wasn't 15 feet high. It was 45 feet high. And the wave that hit Fukushima, it had speed in addition to being 45 feet high, was 150 feet high as it went over top of the nuclear plant. So, you know, we don't have to blame the Daiichi failure on Stuxnet or Israeli intelligence or American intelligence or anything like that. Americans and Japanese did it to themselves by thinking that we were smart enough to beat Mother Nature, and Mother Nature always wins.
Well, I have another question for you from Chirper in Hamilton, Ontario. And he wants to know, what do you think about the nuclear power stations that have leakage and still working? Will this do to the people who live in the area? What will it do? And, you know, what are the consequences?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I was just up in Canada testifying in just outside of Toronto at a place called Pickering, which is a nuclear reactor in that province. The Canadian design is different than the American design, but it's not better. It's just different. The only reactors in the world that are like the Canadian design are in India, and India wanted them not because they were great, but because they could make plutonium bombs out of them. So that the program of nuclear reactors in Canada is at an evolutionary dead end. You know, this is like Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons. Well, the nukes up in Canada are essentially the Neanderthals, and they're approaching, one, the end of their life, and two, the end of existence of that design. they're all along the Great Lakes. And it's terribly frightening to me that you've got eight nuclear plants at Bruce. You had eight at Pickering, but now there's only four, only six rather, operating. This is the public water system for 40 million people. So if they break, we have not faced the consequences of what do you do when 40 million people can't get a drink of fresh water anymore. Now, the day-to-day releases from a power plant concern me because I've seen too many cases where the documents are wrong, where the instruments are wrong. We'll be posting something like that in the future on the Fairwind site. But a lot of these instruments are being poorly calibrated, so we really don't know the releases that are coming out of a nuclear plant. But in comparison to what could come out in the case of an accident, the day-to-day releases are much lower. Canadian reactors release an enormous amount more tritium than American reactors. So the Canadian solution is to just make the tritium standard 10 times higher than the American standard. So, you know, literally on one side of the Great Lakes, we have one standard for tritium, and on the other side of the Great Lakes, the tritium standard is 10 times higher. So if you can't beat them, you just raise the standard. I think Helen Caldicott's comment was, if you can't raise the bridge, you have to lower the water.
Okay, we've got a caller online, Arnie. His name is Steve from Toronto with a question for you. Steve, are you there?
I am. Hi, Arnie. And thank you for the interview. This is fantastic. You remind me very much like Kevin Ryan from United Laboratories, who was fired when he took to NIST and told them about the wrong figures they were using. My question is this. Recently in the United Nations, Benjamin Netanyahu went up and had a very simplistic bomb with two lines drawn on it, sort of like an old cannon bomb. And the lowest section was stage one of nuclear uranium enrichment. Stage two was the middle section, and stage three was the last one. And he was urging America to take action now, and sold Congress and the Senate that Iran was in fact developing so quickly. Is the development in stage one enrichment to stage three, is this a matter of a few months? He had stated Iran was already almost finished stage one, and that there would be stage two and three would come within weeks or months from that. Is it that fast, or were we sold a bill of goods there?
Okay, now I think I know a little bit more about your questions than before. Natural uranium that comes out of the ground is 99.3% uranium-238. And that's not fissile. That doesn't split and create energy. But 0.7% of it is uranium-235, and that's what you want. So now the Canadian reactors figured out a way of running with just natural uranium, the CANDU reactors up by you. I'm having a little sound problem. Are you hearing me okay?
Yes, we are.
Okay, I'm sorry then. I'll keep going. So but the American reactors and reactors everywhere else in the world use a higher enrichment fuel. So American reactors run at about 5% enrichment. And the Iranians and lots of other countries, but we're talking about Iran now, use something called the gas centrifuge. And they spin the uranium as a gas. And because U-238 is a little bit heavier than U-235, it separates. And if you do that repeatedly over many, many months at the very, very high speeds, 50,000 RPM, you separate out the uranium and get the enrichment up to 5%. So all you need to run a nuclear plant is 5% enrichment. Now, you can't make a bomb unless the enrichment is over 20 and more likely 90%. Well, the Iranians appear to be stopping at 20% enrichment. And But to get from 20 to 90% literally only takes 6 months. So they've got they appear to have stopped at 20%. Now one wonders why they even need 20%, because in fact, if you're going to build a nuclear plant, 5% is more than enough. But there's a separate problem in Iran. We seem to be worried about the enrichment of uranium to make a uranium bomb, but the Iranians have started up a nuclear plant now. And that nuclear plant can create, just by running the nuclear plant, plutonium. And so as that nuclear plant runs, the fuel transmutes from uranium-238 into plutonium-239. And that doesn't require enrichment to separate it out. You can chemically separate out the plutonium from the fuel. So I think I don't know. You know, I don't pretend to work for the State Department or whatever. And I know though that within international law, everybody says that under 20%, you can't make a bomb, which is true. But it doesn't take but about 6 months anyway to get from 20% to 90%, at which case you can make a bomb. But I think if we just look at the enrichment issue, we're missing the fact that the Iranians did start up another plant that's operating now, an operating nuclear power plant that can produce plutonium. And, you know, that's how the North Koreans are making their weapons, is with plutonium. That's how the Indians made their weapons, with plutonium. You don't need to enrich uranium to make a bomb. And you know, Iran's got both options open to it. Whether they choose to use it or not, I'm certainly not an international guru. But I can tell you technically, the enrichment is only one half of the issue.
Okay, a question from Ron in Pennsylvania. Arnie, what do you think the potential of thorium reactors for providing our energy needs? Why don't you think they are used or are in use?
Yeah, there was a battle royal in the United States back in the 50s and early 60s about using thorium versus using uranium. And thorium is not fissile, which means that when it splits, it doesn't create energy. But thorium-232 can absorb a neutron and become uranium-233, and it is fissile. So you need some uranium to get the thorium going, and then you can run a nuclear reactor on a thorium cycle. So we had this battle 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and the people that were pushing uranium won, and the people that were pushing thorium wrote books for 40 years, and now it's suddenly coming back in vogue. The reason the uranium won is because we had built bombs, and we had the diffusion plants. We had the separation technology to enrich uranium already. If we hadn't done that, it's likely that we would be trying thorium as well. The thorium has one advantage. It doesn't produce plutonium, but it does produce, you know, a witch's brew of other radioactive materials. So a Daiichi kind of accident can happen with a thorium reactor or a uranium reactor, but the proliferation risk from plutonium doesn't exist with a thorium-232 reactor. You know, but it boils down to what I said earlier about money. We always seem to have a new option on the horizon. To get a thorium reactor up and running would be 20 or 30 years. And, I mean, you can build a lot of solar arrays and windmills in 30 or 40 years. And this is an untried technology. Bradford's comment, I think, runs true. You know, we're trying to solve world hunger by serving everybody caviar.
Okay. Another question from Daniel in England. Do you have any views on nuclear fusion as opposed to nuclear fission?
Boy, that's great. I can remember. You know, I'm 64 years old, and so I graduated college and with my master's degree in nuclear in 72. And fusion was about 10 years away, and it's still about 10 years away. First off, you've got what fusion is all about is creating the energy of the sun. You're squeezing two hydrogen atoms together, and in the process, you create heat. Technically, that's extraordinarily difficult. You know, we thought we could do it 30 years ago when I was a pup engineer, and we're still not there. So the technology of squeezing the hydrogen together is a big problem. But the other problem is that once it fuses, once it creates helium, it gives off an awful lot of neutrons. And the neutrons would destroy the container that the nuclear reaction is occurring in about 3 months. So every 3 months you'd have to build a new power plant because the neutron flux would be so high it would destroy the building that it was built in. And neutrons are electrically neutral, so it's not like you can steer them with some kind of a magnetic containment or something like that. So when we get to the point of being able to squeeze two hydrogen atoms together and get them to fuse, that's just the beginning of the battle. The metallurgy involved in holding this thing together for the long term is an extraordinarily complex deal. Is mankind smart enough to do it? Yeah. Are we wise enough to do it? I hope we can spend our efforts on the fusion reactor that's 93 million miles away instead of worrying about trying to build a fusion reactor in our backyard.
And my question to you, and this is probably going to be the last question of the evening, this process of putting something into the water to try to contain the radioactive material, what do you think, would it be successful in containing the radiation before it's released in the water, or is this just a blow air in your window while we do what we want to do?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Yeah, I think we're going to end on it. Everybody's focused on keeping the radioactive water from leaking out into the Pacific. They're looking at the wrong end of the animal here. They've got to look at trying to prevent the clean water from coming into the nuclear plant. So what I proposed is building a trench between the mountain and the power plant, and on the mountain side, pulling down the water table so that there would be less water coming into the plant. You know, it's sort of like, you know, when you fill a bathtub with the drain closed, the Japanese are trying to build the sides of the bathtub up higher to hold more and more water. You know, my approach is to turn the spigot off and prevent the water from going into the bathtub. So we're looking at the problem from the wrong end. We're trying to keep it out of the Pacific as opposed to keep the clean water from entering the plant. The Japanese are proposing now to build an ice wall all the way around the plant. Never been done before. Bold, yes. Will it work? Well, we'll know in 2 or 3 years when they do it. But for 2 or 3 years, it's going to continue to leak. I had proposed in the book I wrote in Japan 2 years ago to put this trench between the mountain and the reactors and pull down the water table on the mountain side. The question is not, can we keep it out of the Pacific? You can't. It's going to leak into the Pacific. The trick is to keep it from getting contaminated and keep it out of the plant. And the Japanese are not even trying to do that.
Well, either way, it's a no-win situation, whether it contaminates the land or it contaminates the water. If it contaminates the land, how long of a lengthy process does it take for the radiation to leave the ground? Isn't it something like 1,500 years or something to that effect before half of it even goes away?
Yeah, the half-life of the nastiest atom is about cesium is about 30 years. So you'd essentially have to wait about 300 years before it would go away. And really, I'm proposing something really similar to that. I don't think it's worth the Japanese trying to put in young men and highly irradiate them now to decontaminate the Fukushima site. I think they got to stop the water from getting in. But as soon as they do that, it's time to entomb those reactors and walk away for 100 years. 100 years from now, the radiation levels will be 10 times less. And if if without water seeping into the bottom, why are we willing to expose, you know, thousands of young Japanese to extraordinarily high radiation levels? The answer the Japanese have actually said, and it's unfortunate, if we leave the plants there, people will think nuclear is not safe. So it's all about money. The Japanese want to knock those plants down to take people's mind off of Fukushima Daiichi. And they're willing to use their young men, we call them gamma sponges, you know, to go into these plants and sponge up the gamma rays so that they can continue to sell more nuclear plants.
Wow. One more question. We've got a little bit of time. Let's make it a quick one. The ground, say, at the test site in Vegas, or was it, yes, I believe it was Vegas or Nevada where they did the nuclear testing. Do you feel that that dirt is still contaminated?
The answer is yeah. But a nuclear bomb makes different isotopes than a nuclear reactor. And because it's a fast, it uses fast neutrons versus slow neutrons. It's way too complicated for tonight. But the half-life of the material from a nuclear bomb actually lasts in the environment much less than the half-life of radiation from a nuclear reactor. You know, Nagasaki and Hiroshima are functioning cities now, in part because the radiation half-life, because they were bombed and not had a nuclear reactor blow up next to them, it decays much faster.
I see. Because I've heard of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases of cancer in the Vegas area, and that was the only culprit that I could actually point the finger at.
Yeah, a good friend of mine was died of cancer, and he was one of those soldiers that they sent in to run toward the weapon as right after it blew up. Yeah, there's plenty of radiation on the ground out there, and I don't think we're getting a good epidemiological study out of the United States government. I don't think they really want to know. My friend, who was a GI, said that the route that they told him he took, which was much less radiation exposure, was nowhere near the route that he took as a GI. And they deliberately changed the path that he took on their maps to create the illusion that this guy picked up a lot less radiation than he really did.
Wow, it's incredible. Arnie, I would like to thank you for your time and being our guest here on the People Speak Radio. Well, unfortunately, we have to say goodnight to you, and it's been a pleasure having you. Maybe sometime in the near future we'll have you back again and go through more of this process on the Fukushima plant. Once again, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, and you have a really smart audience. I liked it a lot.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and you have a good evening, sir.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall by the relief of fast as summer people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.